So this is work in collaboration with three people: Kent Tiagi from Montana State, Diego Blas from CERN, and Nicholas Younes at Montana State. And in particular, Kent did an awful lot of work about this project. So if anyone should take the credit for this work, it's him. And of course, should I say any nonsense along the way, it's only my fault. So first, a brief outline of the talk. So this talk is, by the way, going to be about strong binary process constraints on Lorentz violation in gravity. So I'm trying to constrain Lorentz violation in the gravitational sector, which is, I guess, why I was invited for a quantum gravity seminar, because Lorentz violation in the gravity sector is a hot topic when you try to construct models of quantum gravity. So in the first part of the talk, for those of you who are not quantum gravitists, I will try to motivate why we try to break Lorentz symmetry in the gravitational sector, and also how we break Lorentz symmetry. In particular, I will focus on two theories, which I will argue are the most general way of breaking boost invariance in the gravitational sector at low energies. And these are called Einstein-Ether theory and chronometric gravity. This will be the first part of the talk. The middle part of the talk will be about trying to connect Lorentz violation to something which is more readily observable in astrophysics, which is the possible violations of the strong equivalence principle. So we'll try to make a connection between Lorentz violation and violations of the strong equivalence principle. And so I'll try to give you the physics behind that. And in particular, in the third part of the talk, because the strong equivalence principle is very tightly constrained in astrophysics, this will allow me to put constraints on the coupling constants of the theory. And this would be in particular with systems which are known as binary pulsars. So why do we want to break Lorentz symmetry in the gravitational sector in the first place? So according to your background, there might be different answers to this question. There are phenomenological motivations and theoretical motivations. So if you're a theorist, in particular if you do quantum gravity, you know that it's actually much easier to construct a completion, quantum gravity completion to general relativity if you break Lorentz symmetry. And the famous example of this fact is given by a theory which was proposed a few years ago by Hojava, in which you break Lorentz symmetry in the gravity sector, and as a reward, you manage to construct a theory which is power counting renormalizable. So this is one motivation. There are phenomenological motivations coming from essentially cosmology. If you want to explain dark energy or dark matter phenomenology without introducing actually any dark matter or any dark energy, a possible way to do so is to introduce Lorentz violating vector fields. And by doing so, you can explain dark energy and dark matter without any actual dark matter or dark energy. And Ney Ash has a theory of this kind. I think he's not here today. I think he was traveling. But this is another example of possible motivations for breaking Lorentz symmetry in the gravity sector. And there are also phenomenological motivations. To me, the most appealing phenomenological motivations is that we don't know much about Lorentz violation in the gravity sector. And in particular, people have been put strong constraints on Lorentz violation in the matter sector, but we have very weak constraints in the gravity sector. So it makes sense to ask whether we can do better than that. And in particular, people have been trying to do so since the 60s, the 70s, the golden age of tests of general relativity. And so essentially, what they tried to do in the 60s, starting from Nordbecht and other people, was to put constraints on Lorentz violation in gravity at what we call the first post-Newtonian order, so at the level of the solar system. So for those of you who are not relativists, when I say 1PN, I mean first post-Newtonian order, which means an effect which is suppressed compared to Newtonian gravity by a factor V over C squared, where V is, of course, the characteristic speed of your system. However, I could give you many examples of theories which agree with general relativity at 1PN order, and they differ from general relativity at higher post-Newtonian orders. So just because people have been putting constraints on Lorentz violation at 1PN order, it doesn't mean that we couldn't have violations of Lorentz symmetry at higher post-Newtonian order, which is what we call in technical jargon the strong field regime. So this is the why we want to break Lorentz symmetry in the gravity sector. As to how we do it, first of all, I should mention that we don't break Lorentz symmetry to Kur. We break boost invariance. So in order to break boost invariance, what we do is to introduce at each point of your spacetime, a time-like vector field which points in the forward, which selects a preferred time. So we introduce what we call an ether vector field, which is time-like. We normalize it to norm one, but that's just simply a technical, that's simply because of convenience. And this specifies the preferred time direction. So in this way, you explicitly break boost invariance. And then what we do, we construct the most generic action that we can think of in four dimensions using first order, using at most quadratic orders in the derivatives. So we want an action which is quadratic in the derivatives of the ether field. And it turns out that the most generic action that you can write is an action of this kind, in which you have the usual Einstein-Hilbert action plus this kinetic term for the ether, which is non-standard because in front of it you have this matrix M, which is defined in terms of the metric and in terms of the ether field itself. And what matters for this talk is that this matrix depends on four dimensionless coupling constants, C1, C2, C3, and C4. And these are exactly what I'm going to constrain in this talk. So this is the most generic action that you can write at quadratic order in derivatives, therefore at low energies, in which you violate boost invariance explicitly in the gravity sector. So this is what we call the Einstein ether action. And of course, this describes the gravitational sector. And now we want to add matter into to the game. And so we add it. We add matter, which I denoted here with well, schematically with some field psi. We add matter. We couple matter minimally to the metric. And the reason why we do so is that we want to enforce the weak equivalence principle. So the reason, so for those of you who forgot what the equivalence principle is, it simply states that a body follows a trajectory which is independent of its mass. So for instance, in GR, dust particles, the sun, the moon, the earth, the black holes, everything follows geodesics, and the mass doesn't appear explicitly in the geodesic equation. So the weak equivalence principle is exactly this statement applied to weakly gravitating bodies, such as, for instance, the sun or the moon or the earth. In order to, so if you couple matter minimally to the metric and you take the variation of this action with respect to the matter fields, what you get is exactly the geodesic equation. So this matter action enforces the weak equivalence principle. Yep.
Sorry, about this general action, why don't you have u alpha, u beta, u mu, u nu?
Well, u alpha, u beta.
Which is quadratic in ether field. Oh, sorry, quartic in ether field.
Do you want to add a term which?
No. In the second line, when you write m alpha, beta, and mu, nu, why can't I have a combination u alpha, u beta, u mu, u nu?
Yeah, in principle, you could. We want something which is, so we want something which is quadratic in the.
It would be zero. It's a norm of the unit norm.
Yeah, that's okay.
But I guess the related question is why physically do we get to take the norm to be one?
I'm sorry, why physically we get what?
That begs the question of why do we take the norm to be one?
You can actually norm one is not restrictive from that, from because you can simply rescale your couplings and that would make it. What is restrictive that it is time-like. So if you rescale, you can rescale your ether, and therefore you rescale your coupling constants. So that would do. Because the ether is always multiplied by some coupling constants. So if you rescale it to another norm, this is.
So I mean, the magnitude of u could be a dynamical
degree. Yeah, but I think that would be. I'm pretty sure it's degenerate with the coupling constants. I mean, I can always define, I could leave u with norm undefined, but then I can define a new field, auxiliary field, which has unit norm, and simply rescale my coordinates. Well, maybe we can talk about that later. I'm pretty sure it's.
There are ghosts in this?
No, there are no ghosts. No, I'll talk about, no, there are no ghosts.
You're going to talk about that?
I'm going to talk about that, yeah. So this is one, so, well, modulo this. This unit norm thing that we need to discuss, I think this is the most generic action for, that you can write at low energies, at quadratic order in derivatives. Actually, we didn't write this action in the first place. I mean, this was proposed by Jacobson a few years ago. Another way in which you can break Lorentz invariance in the gravitational sector, however, is to impose additional constraints on your unit, on your time-like vector field. So if instead of specifying a time-like, a preferred time-like direction at each point of your space-time, you want to specify a global foliation of your space-time, what you can ask is that your ether be hypersurface orthogonal. So you can ask for the ether to be essentially the gradient of a scalar. So this scalar, capital T, we call the chronon. And this is because the ether is a time-like vector. This chronon defines a time coordinate on your space-time. So you can use the value of the chronon as your time coordinate. And if you plug this expression of the ether into the Einstein ether action that you got that I introduced in the previous slide, you get what we call chronometric gravity. And some people among the audience might be used to another form in which you can write the action for chronometric gravity. In particular, you can, because the, as I said, the chronon can be used as the time coordinate, you can rewrite your chronometric gravity action using coordinates that are adapted to the chronon. And if you do so, you get an expression of this, an expression like this. So you open a JR textbook, you express the four-dimensional Ricci scalar in terms of the lapse of the shift, the three-dimensional metric, and the extrinsic curvature, and you get an expression like this, in which you have the extrinsic curvature of the capital T equals constant surfaces. You have the trace of the extrinsic curvature. You have the three-dimensional Ricci scalar, and you have also the gradient of the lapse. Okay, so, and there are also three-dimensional coupling constants. So we went from four-dimensional coupling constants of the Einstein ether action to just three coupling constants. And the reason why you have that is that the ether is now hypersurface orthogonal. So this introduces a relation among the coupling constants. So you can actually re-express one of the four coupling constants in terms of the other three. So this is the chronometric gravity action. And the reason why I said that some among the audience might be familiar with this is that chronometric gravity is actually the low energy limit of Hojava gravity. So Hojava gravity, as I mentioned, is a theory of gravity which is power counting renormalizable. And in a preferred time foliation, the action looks like this. So you have a low order in second order in derivative terms, which is given by the same action of chronometric gravity that I just introduced, plus you have higher order terms in the spatial derivatives. So these are L4 and L6. So L4 and L6 are terms which are of fourth order in the spatial derivatives and sixth order in the spatial derivatives. And they're actually crucial to allow the theory to become power counting renormalizable. However, these terms are suppressed by a mass scale M star. So in general, you would expect that at low energy, these terms shouldn't play any role. But that depends, of course, on the value of this constant M star. And this is where things get a little bit tricky. Because on the one hand, we know that M star, and this is quite intuitive, is bounded from below from experiments. But the exact bound that we should place on this mass scale M star is actually not known. Because in general, when you break Lorentz invariance in the gravitational sector, because gravity is coupled to matter, you also have a certain degree of violation of Lorentz invariance in the matter sector. And this is what, in technical jargon, is called percolation of the Lorentz violation into the matter sector. The problem is that the details of this percolation depend on the higher order terms in the derivatives. So according to what terms, higher order terms in the derivatives you choose, you can have different mechanisms for this percolation. So you might have, so in principle, you could have a high degree of Lorentz violation in the matter sector, which would be very constrained by experiments, for instance, in the standard model. So it's not clear. So the lower bound on M star is model dependent and could go anywhere from 10 to the minus 3 up to 10 to the 16 GeV. So it could be this M star could actually be constrained from below up to a very large value, according to what to the specific form of the L4 and L6 terms. On the other hand, and quite surprisingly, people have discovered that there is a theoretical constraint on M star. So in particular, quite counterintuitively, if M star is too large, for instance, if M star is at the Planck scale, you have a theory which is strongly coupled. And this you don't want, because if you want a theory which is power counting renormalizable, you don't want the theory to become strongly coupled. Otherwise, the power counting renormalizability doesn't apply. So you want M star to be less to the 16 GeV. So the range for M star, as I said, is very murky at the present. There's no consensus on what the lower bound should be. But nevertheless, for the purposes of this talk, the higher order terms will be completely negligible. So in particular, it turns out that if you do a dimensional analysis at the level of neutron stars, which is the subject of this talk, the effects of the L4 term will be about 10 to the minus 14, so completely negligible. So please.
Because the theory is power counting regularized does not mean it's renormalizable.
Yeah, no, I mean,
you're violating local Lorentz invariants, and that's crucial. You do renormalize.
Yeah, so maybe somebody in the audience knows about this. I mean, this talk will be about how you put constraints on the lower order terms L2. So this is just a theoretical. I mean, I think the theory is power counting renormalizable. Doesn't mean it's normalizable. There is no proof. Yeah, yeah. Well, as I said, whatever we put, I think the power counter renormalizable claim still holds, but I haven't looked at the details myself because this is a talk about the lowest order terms L2. So
I think it's correct, actually.
You don't think that's correct? Well, maybe somebody in the audience knows better about this. Sorry. This talk will be about how to put constraints on the lower order derivative operators L2. So this is just a motivational slide. So how to, so if you like Poincaré gravity, all what I will say about chronometric gravity, which is the action L2, will transfer to Poincaré gravity. If you don't like Poincaré gravity, well, maybe you should take just a low order action as a theory in itself, just like when you consider scalar tensor theory, for instance, as an effective theory at low energies. So as I said, people in the past put constraints on the low-order action at the level of the solar system, which is what we call 1PN order. So the way we do so is to do a post-Newtonian expansion, as I said, expand the dynamics in order V over C, where V is the characteristic velocity of the binary. So at Newtonian order, the theory looks like GR. There are no deviations from GR. When you go to first post-Newtonian order, you actually have deviations away from GR. So in particular, if you construct what we call a parameterized post-Newtonian expansion, all the parameters appearing in this expansion are exactly the same as in GR, with the exception of two parameters, which are called preferred frame parameters, alpha 1 and alpha 2. So these parameters are zero in GR. They're non-zero in chronometric gravity or in Einstein ether theory. However, experimentally, we know that these parameters must be less than 10 to the minus 5 and 10 to the minus 9, and they are dimensionless. So it makes sense to assume, to impose that alpha 1 and alpha 2 are exactly 0. And this you can do in Lorentz violating gravity. So if you impose that alpha 2 and alpha 1 are exactly 0, you introduce a relation between the couplings. So in particular, you go from four coupling constants that you have in Einstein ether theory to just two coupling constants, which we call C plus and C minus, which are a combination of the original couplings. And in the case of chronometric gravity, we go from three to two couplings. And the couplings that survive are some combinations of the original couplings and are called lambda and beta. So this C plus and C minus and lambda and beta parameters do not appear at 1PN order, which is why they are unconstrained by solar system tests, but they appear at higher post-Newtonian order. So in this sense, they are coupling constants that appear in the strong field. So what I will try to do in this talk is to put constraints on the strong field coupling constants. So there are theoretical constraints that you can put on these coupling constants. And these come from the requirement that the theory is stable. And so in Einstein ether theory, The gravitational field is described by the usual spin 2 graviton of general relativity. And besides that, you have a vector and scalar degrees of freedom. So we have a spin 1 and a spin 0 propagating mode. And similarly, in chronometric gravity, you have a spin 0 and spin 2 mode. So you just have a scalar degree of freedom in chronometric gravity because you So you have a spin 0 degree of freedom and a spin 2 degree of freedom. And now this is, I think, the answer to your question whether there are ghosts in this theory. And so first of all, you want the theory not to have ghosts, or even better, not to have a tachyonic instability at the classical level. So we impose that the propagation speeds of these modes is real, because if this the propagation speed is imaginary and you have a wave equation, you have an exponential instability at the classical level. So I think this is what you meant by ghosts. And
how do you impose that?
Well, we solve the equations over Minkowski.
Non-linearly?
Linearly, yeah. There are no ghosts at the linear level, yeah.
No, but you have to solve non-linearly. To show that there's no instability, you have to...
Well, we solve...
So
you mean then, so on a non-trivial background or to quadratic order? I mean, we expand the action at quadratic order, of course, to get the field equations at first order.
Right, but you're going to be using this theory in situations where gravity becomes strong.
No, yeah, I don't think this has been, this has not been proven.
Whether it's stable or
yeah,
not.
No, this has not been proven, and I don't think anybody has looked at that.
But isn't this, the theory still linearly degenerate? It isn't quasi-linear, and then if you linearize with respect to any particular background solution, the characteristics, you can still make them.
Yeah, I think the structure of the space and the causal structure wouldn't change.
In which case, then it's still fine.
Yeah, so I'm not sure from a mathematical point of view if there are counterexamples to this statement, but I would expect not to have any. Well, this I don't know, because nobody has ever looked actually at, for instance, even in black hole space times, nobody has ever looked at perturbations quasi-normal modes. This hasn't been
well, but the nonlinear stability is a very tough question, even in Minkowski and GR.
No, but one thing is nonlinear stability, and the other one is the dispersion relation you get. Assuming you have a background solution, whatever that is, whatever strong field gravity you may have, and then you look for perturbations over that solution, what is the spectrum?
Well, that would mean
what Harold was asking was the nonlinear.
Right,
it's not clear to me if I find
are there nonlinear instabilities?
Right. But
if you have an energy that is unbounded below, presumably this new field, doesn't have a positive energy.
Yeah, I think if you impose this at the linear level, we have positive energy. I don't know. At the nonlinear level, I don't know.
Nonlinearly, the energy isn't positive. So it's quite conceivable that this field runs away, accumulates lots of energy,
perturbations have been
graviton.
We studied perturbations only on Minkowski background. But even if we found an unstable, I mean, if we studied, background would you do that? Would you do
you
that?
You see that the energy isn't positive. You really have to worry whether the theory makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, one in principle could expand. Yeah. Okay. No, but I think
I would look for the problem, not try to.
But I think I think you can, because actually you can write down the equivalent of, for instance, for a generic space time, you can write down the equivalent of the Comar mass for that space time, and I think that's positive. That's always positive.
So
that would do it, I think, for a generic background.
So none of the usual the stability of Minkowski space or any other space would hold in this theory.
So I'm sorry, say again.
None of the proofs of the stability of that space time or any other space time would hold in this theory. So that's something to worry about.
Yeah, that's one of the things you might worry about. There are many other things you can worry
about.
Where
the flat space is stable?
The flat space is stable.
Linearly,
yeah.
Non-linear?
Linearly, I don't know. But I believe so, because as I said, you can write down for a generic space time, a generic curve space time, you can write down the equivalent of the ADM energy of that space time. So that
that's not positive. In this theory.
I'll double check this. I'm pretty sure it is positive. Once you not in general for all the coupling constants. Why would that be negative? I don't understand.
Well, can you find field? The question.
Well,
is
I know that at linear level. I know that at linear level. That's true. I don't know the answer.
You introduce a non-positive metric into your matter Lagrangian.
So the metric,
the energy of this field will be negative. some components of it.
So at the linear level, what happens is that the ether perturbation coupled to a metric which is not, as you said, correctly the metric g mu nu, but it's g mu nu plus u mu u nu.
Right.
So and from that we infer the stability because it turns out that the coefficient in front of there's a coefficient in front of u nu, and the sign of that tells you whether the theory is linearly stable or unstable. So, but that's only been done at the linear level. I agree. So one in principle could look for the generalization. Anyway, maybe I should go on. So this is one constraint that we so stability at linear level. So the absence of what people call ghosts sometimes. Or tachyonic instability at the quantum level. The other constraint that we put is that the propagation speed of these modes is larger than the speed of light, because it has been shown that if the propagation speed of these modes were lower than the speed of light, then photons would decay. People argue that they would decay into these gravitational modes and give rise to gravitational Cherenkov radiation. So it's another, in a sense, another kind of instability.
Is that related to the ghost-like nature of these modes?
Well, no, I think at the non-linear level, it has nothing. At the linear level, it has nothing to do. I mean, in one case, you impose that the speed is real. In the other case, you assume that the speed is larger than one. So you know, Cherenkov radiation in the electromagnetism is when you have a shock wave that excites. So in this case, you have something similar. You create a gravitational shock wave.
Yeah, but normally we would insist the speed is less than the speed of light to avoid.
Well, in this case, we would be screwed because we would have no room left. Because this, I haven't done this work myself. This is a review of the work. So it's been shown that you must have speed larger than the speed of light. Otherwise, your mode would decay. Your photons would decay.
Extremely strange result.
What?
I mean, do you find it strange?
No, I don't find it strange. I mean, I would find the opposite strange. So because if I had light. I mean, if the speed was lower than the speed of light, don't you expect that there should be some Cherenkov type emissions?
Well, if something, I mean, you know, if you drive sound waves.
Yeah.
I mean, if you run
it's like
from the air,
exactly,
when you go faster than the speed of light, like, then you create shock waves.
No, but you have Cherenkov radiation whenever you move at a speed which is larger than the propagation speed of light in that medium. So in this case, you would have a gravitational medium, and you would have light traveling in this ether field at speed larger than the ether itself. So you would excite the ether, just like in the same way in which you excite charges or dipoles in Cherenkov radiation. So I don't quite see why you find it strange.
Can you have an object made of this U field that moves faster than the speed of light?
An object made of the U field, you mean
you would say it has to move faster than the speed of light, any object.
No, you can have a wave. Yeah, you can have a wave. You have waves.
And
in fact,
it has to move faster than
the speed of light. You have black holes. We have different horizons for the spin two gravitons, the spin zero graviton, the spin one graviton.
So when that object moves faster than the speed of light, how does it couple to gravitational waves?
Well, this is the gravitational field itself.
No,
does it couple to the spin to graviton at
low? You've got some wave in the U field moving.
It will couple. All the perturbations will be coupled, which is why it's hard to study the stability of nonlinear space times, because the spin two graviton will be coupled to the spin one graviton if the background is not Minkowski.
So I'm really confused. I have an object moving faster than the speed of
this
the
is
sound,
a wave,
i.e. the gravitational wave speed. I have an object moving faster than that speed.
Yeah, it will excite gravity. So it will excite spin two graviton.
Terrible.
No, it would be more terrible
that
if
would
I had
stop
a,
it moving faster than the speed of light.
It will change definitely
because
the velocity.
Because it has to lose energy.
Yeah, so it will be attractive.
Unless you say when it loses energy, it goes faster?
No, I think it goes, no, but why would it? I really don't understand. If I have a spin zero particle, that would lose energy to the spin two particle.
Mm-hmm.
That I agree. So it would be dragged towards the speed of light at nonlinear level. That I agree.
So the propagation
speed
will go down to the speed of light?
Yeah.
Because
at non-linear level, I presume so, because you have the spin zero graviton, which is going to be coupled to the speed.
But it will always remain faster than the speed.
Yes. Yeah.
Therefore, it would always lose energy.
Asymptotically, when the difference between the velocity will be small, I presume the energy, the loss of energy, will asymptotically go to zero. So it could be the speed of light could be an attractor at the non-linear level. I don't see So this is...
These things need to be shown.
This thing needs to be shown. In fact, one of the projects we have is to look at the perturbations. You have to choose on which spacetime you would like to do this. Black hole spacetimes, the stability...
I would just choose a 1 plus 1 dimensional spacetime.
Well, in 1 plus 1 dimension, the action is even different. The action I wrote is the most generic action in 4 dimensions, if you choose...
No, I mean 4 dimensions, but with symmetry.
You mean a spherical...
You take a wave of U field going faster than the speed of light, see what happens. I mean, okay.
Yeah, so monopolar perturbation, that might be easy. Yeah.
Pardon?
Monopolar perturbations, might be easy. But still, I don't think, even if the picture that I just described were to happen in reality, and I think it does, I don't see why that would be not viable experimentally. I think Cherenkov radiation would be what would make it non-viable experimentally, because we don't observe gravitational waves. I agree, if we observe gravitational waves, then it would be fine. Since we don't observe gravitational waves, but we observe photons, then I think this constraint is the one that you should impose.
We agree that when things go faster than the speed of propagation in the medium, you create a shock wave.
Yes, that's Cherenkov radiation.
Your picture is that any object, any such object, will inevitably create a shockwave.
Yes, that's exactly. That's exactly.
Then the theory will break down.
Yeah, that's. I'm sorry.
Then the theory will break down.
The linear description will break down, because if you have a shockwave, why would the theory break down? The description that you give it in terms of linear perturbations would break down.
Well, that's the definition of a shockwave.
Exactly.
That's when the continuum.
But the theory is not linear. Yeah, but the theory is not linear. Maybe I think from the general relativistic point of view, but I mean, I don't see anything wrong with having a shock wave in the gravitational field. At any rate, these are the constraints. If you impose Cherenkov radiation this way, Cherenkov constraints this way, this is what you get. So these are the two strong field coupling constants, C plus and C minus. This is the parameter space for Einstein Ether theory. So GR corresponds to zero value of the coupling constants. And the viable region of the parameter space is given by this cyan region. In the case of chronometric gravity, the strong field coupling constants are, again, this beta and lambda, as we call them. GR is the origin again. And the coupling constants can have values of order 10, or for the case of beta, of order 1. So this is the viable region. So you see, coupling constants are essentially, well, they're somewhat constrained, but they can have values of order 1. And in principle, you can try and do cosmology in these theories. For instance, as I said, people like Niyesh have introduced theories of this kind to explain cosmology, to explain the dark energy and the dark matter phenomenology. So what people did, I didn't do, all this is not my work. All this is a review of what has been done in the literature, imposed constraints coming from the CMB in Einstein-Ether theory and from BBN in Einstein-Ether theory. And it turns out that there are no constraints essentially on Einstein-Ether theory besides those that I just reviewed. However, the situation is very different in chronometric gravity. There are no constraints from the CMB yet, but people have worked out the constraints coming from BBN, Big Bang Nucleosynthesis. And it turns out that there are very tight constraints coming from BBN, from the fact that Big Bang Nucleosynthesis theory agrees with observations. So in particular, the coupling constants are constrained to this very small region near GR. So in particular, the coupling constants are of order 4% and 10%. So the reason why there are such strong constraints coming from BBN is that when you work out the Friedman equations in these theories, the gravitational constant appearing in the Friedman equations is different from the local gravitational constant measured in the solar system. And the relation between the two is given by some function of the coupling constants. And from BBN, you know that the difference between the gravitational constant during nucleosynthesis cannot be very different from the local value of the gravitational constant. So they must be close. And this is how you get these very tight constraints on Lorentz violation in gravity from cosmology. So all this is what the status was. So I'm a bit late on the schedule, so I'll move on to the next, to what we actually did. So what we actually did was to try to use astrophysics to put further constraints on this theory. And the reason why we know that there must be a way to put further constraints on these theories with astrophysics is an effect which was found in the 60s by Nordbeck, essentially. It's called Nordbeck effect. And he discovered it in the case of scalar tensor theories and Brunstiger theory. So what he found was that in Brunstiger theory, you don't have a direct coupling between the scalar field and matter. But matter is coupled to gravity, of course, and the metric is coupled non-minimally to the scalar field. So when you go to nonlinear orders in your gravitational perturbation expansion, you introduce an effective coupling between matter and the scalar field in scalar tensor theories. So the same happens in our case. So matter is not coupled to the ether directly, but the ether is coupled non-minimally to gravity. So when you go to, when you do higher order perturbation theory, when you go to, when you do loops, what you find is that there is an effective coupling between the ether and matter. So this introduces some sort of fifth force. So you will have deviation, necessarily you will have deviations of the strong equivalence principle. So in particular, if you consider in, if you consider a neutron star, because we have a theory in which boost invariance is violated, you would expect that the binding energy of the neutron star should be related to the motion with respect to the ether. So if you have a star which is at rest with respect to the ether, you would expect to have a very different structure from the case in which the neutron star is moving with respect to the ether, right? Because boost invariance is violated. So the two cases can't be equivalent. So in particular, what you would expect is that the binding energy of the neutron star should be a function of the Lorentz factor relative to the ether. So if the binding energy is a function of the Lorentz factor in GR, in general relativity, everything, or in the relativistic gravity theories, everything gravitates, including the binding energy. So the binding energy contributes to the mass of a compact object. So when you try to describe your, a system, for instance, of two neutron stars by means of a point particle approximation, what you need to do is to include a dependence of the masses of the neutron stars on the Lorentz factor, on the motion with respect to the ether, because the binding energy must depend on the Lorentz factor. So if you take this matter action and take variations of this matter action relative to the coordinates, instead of getting the usual geodesic equation of general relativity, what you find is something which has the four acceleration on the left-hand side, minus, and on the right-hand side, you'll have contributions from the derivatives of the masses with respect to the Lorentz factor. So you will have, for neutron stars, you will have deviations away from geodesic equation, and therefore you will have deviations away from the strong equivalence principle. And this is something that we can constrain astrophysically because we know that the strong equivalence principle is very well constrained, for instance, from the Hals-Taylor pulsar. So even more importantly, in a theory in which you have a violation of the strong equivalence principle, you would expect to have production of dipolar gravitational waves. In fact, the reason why in general relativity you don't have any production of dipolar gravitational waves is rooted in the strong equivalence principle. So suppose you have your Minkowski metric or any metric you want, and you do perturbations over that metric. You write down your metric perturbation H, which is dimensionless. And simply by dimensional analysis, you could conceive that there could be a term like this, where M1 is the matter dipole, the density dipole, or sorry, the matter, the mass dipole, which is defined as this integral over the density times the coordinate. So this is allowed from dimensional analysis. The only reason why this term doesn't give you a gravitational wave in general relativity is that the derivative of the mass dipole in general relativity is given by the linear momentum. And the linear momentum is conserved. So this perturbation that I wrote is not actually a wave. It's a static potential. It's like a post-Newtonian potential, if you want. So in a theory such as gravimetric gravity, Einstein ether, or Brunstiger theory, scalar tensor theories, in which you have violations of the strong equivalence principle, the derivative of the mass dipole will not be given by the linear momentum of the system. But it will be given by the linear momentum of the system with the addition of other contributions that depend on the derivatives of the masses with respect to the Lorentz factor. And so this is why, in general, if you break the strong equivalence principle, you will have dipolar emission of gravitational waves. And this you could detect directly using interferometers or indirectly through their, through the Beck reaction on the orbit of a binary system. So this is, of course, not the way in which we do the calculation. So this is, so now I have four technical slides, so I'll try to, a few technical slides, I'll try to skim very quickly through them because I'm running out of time. So this is actually what we do. We do a post-Newtonian analysis of our field equations, and we calculate eventually the dipolar flux emitted by a binary system of two neutron stars. So just very schematically, so we write the action of the system as a point particle action, but we introduce a dependence of the masses on the motion with respect to the ether. So this is the gamma factor with respect to the ether. The ether is capital U, and the fluid for velocity is small u. Sorry, the neutron star for velocity is small u. And then we do a Taylor expansion around the word line. The derivative of the mass with respect to the Lorentz factor we call the sensitivity of the neutron star. And we also have the derivative of the sensitivity, essentially. So these two are parameters that we don't know about, but which will enter into our post-Newtonian expansion. And so these parameters will, so when we do our post-Newtonian expansion, already at Newtonian orders, we will see deviations away from the strong equivalence principle. In particular, at Newtonian level, we find that the Newtonian two-body interaction is modified by the presence of these sensitivities. And this is the same thing I said in the previous slide. Because you have a dependence of the mass with respect to the gamma factor, the derivative of the mass with respect to the gamma factor will enter into your Newtonian interaction. And this is, well, this is the same as saying that the strong equivalence principle is violated. But maybe this is a bit technical. So essentially, but what is important is that we go to higher post-Newtonian order, and we go on and calculate the flux, the dipole flux, the flux emitted in gravitational waves. So to do so, we have to go to 1.5 PN order to find the dipolar emission, and to 2.5 post-Newtonian order, for those who know what this means, to calculate the quadrupolar flux. So this is an awful expression. I just highlighted that the sensitivities of the body enter all over the place. So this is the quadrupole emission, and you have a dependence on the sensitivities. And most of all, you have a dipole emission, which is completely absent in general relativity, which is proportional to the difference between the sensitivities of the two bodies. So S1 and S2 are simply remappings of the sensitivities. So dipolar emission, as I said, appears at lower post-Newtonian order. So it becomes it's actually potentially more important than quadrupolar emission because it for a widely separated binary, it's going to be the main effect. But it's suppressed by the difference between the sensitivities of the two neutron stars. So if you have an equal mass neutron star, dipolar emission will be absent. However, if you have, for instance, a neutron star and a white dwarf, the white dwarf will have a very different sensitivity from the neutron star. So this effect will actually be present. And in fact, to constrain the theory, we looked at neutron star white dwarf systems. And the way we constrain, the reason why we calculate this dipolar flux is, of course, the fact that we know that there are systems in the sky for which we observe the emission of gravitational waves, although indirectly. And these are what are known as binary pulsars. So this is a famous example, and I guess almost everybody is familiar with this. So this is the famous Hals-Taylor pulsar. So it's a system of a neutron star and a pulsar. So a pulsar is a magnetized neutron star, and the symmetry axis of the magnetic field is misaligned with the rotation axis. So the star emits radio pulses, probably synchrotron radiation, in our direction at regular intervals. And this can be used to track the period of the binary system. And the period decreases due to the emission of gravitational waves. And this is the GR prediction for this particular system. And these are the data over a span of 30 years. And you see, to within the observational errors, this pulsar agrees completely with general relativity. So what we want to do is to compare systems like these to the dipolar flux that I wrote in the previous slide. So this dipolar flux depends on these sensitivities, sigma 1 and sigma 2, which we need to calculate, because these are dependent on the system. So for instance, if you consider a neutron star or a white dwarf, this will be different. So the other technical slides that I have are the calculations of the sensitivities. I'm not sure if I should go into so much detail. If nobody's interested, maybe I'll, since I'm running out of time, I'll move to, maybe I'll give you a very brief hint of what we do. So for those of you who are relativists, what we do is very similar to derivation of the first law of black hole thermodynamics. So the sensitivities, as I wrote in the previous slide and as I repeated ad nauseum, are the derivatives of the mass with respect to the Lorentz factor. So the derivatives of the mass with respect to the velocity of the ether. So what we need to do is to write down the equivalent of the Comar mass for a system of two neutron stars. And this is where I think one could show that the theory has no ghosts at the nonlinear level. Because when you can write down an energy, at least for, I mean, this is the version for a static system. Let me go in order. So what we consider is a system in which your neutron star is at rest relative to the ether. So the ether is moving with respect to it. And so what we do, I don't want to enter into the details, is to write down the total Comar mass of the system, or Hamiltonian mass of the system, and vary that. And so when you take, and because you are in a stationary situation, this mass is actually the integral of the Lagrangian. So when you vary this, when you take the variation of this mass with respect to the velocity, with respect to the ether, you have a bunch of bulk terms which go away because of the of your field equations. And you have a bunch of surface terms which do not go away. So what we manage to do is to relate the variation of the energy of a neutron star moving with respect to the ether. We manage to relate it to some surface integral, which you can evaluate far away from the neutron star. So this is very similar to what you do in GR when you write down the Comar mass of a space-time. And you can either calculate the Comar mass as the integral of the stress energy tensor over the surface of your neutron star, or you can go to spatial infinity and evaluate the ADM mass, which turns out to be the same as the ADM mass. So what we did in this paper was essentially to write down a similar derivation for the mass of a neutron star moving with respect to the ether. And when we wrote the variation of this mass in terms of a surface integral, which we can now evaluate. And because the variation of the mass with respect to the velocity is actually the sensitivity, what we are able is to write down an expression for the sensitivity in terms of an asymptotic solution of our neutron star far away from the system, near spatial infinity. Well, maybe this is a bit technical, but I'm sorry I have to rush through this. So this asymptotic, in order to find this asymptotic solution, we must first find the solution in the interior and then integrate out. So what we do is essentially an expansion in the velocity of the neutron star. But maybe I'll just move to the results because this is pretty technical. So essentially what we do is the equivalent of a Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff equation in general relativity. We do this at zeroth order in the velocity with respect to the ether and at first order with respect to the ether. And to make a long story short, this is what we find. These are the sensitivities of our neutron stars. And again, the sensitivities are the constants that enter into the dipolar flux. So this is the ingredient that we need to calculate dipolar fluxes. So these are the sensitivities for chronometric gravity. And these are the sensitivities for Einstein ether theory. So the first panel, the x-axis, horizontal axis, is the compactness of the system. So each point in this plot corresponds to a different neutron star. The compactness is the mass of the neutron stars divided by the radius. So what we show are the sensitivities of different neutron stars as you make the neutron star more and more compact. And we do so for different equations of state for the neutron star. And as you see, there is very little difference when you consider different equations of state. But this is something we needed to do because in order to put constraints on the theory, since we don't know the equation of state of nuclear matter, we need to consider different equations of state. And so these are the predictions of our of our calculation. And this is the prediction of a weak field calculation that was performed 7 years ago by Foster, who at the time was a PhD student at the University of Maryland. So he came up with these very nice compact expressions for the sensitivities in terms of the binding energy of the system. So omega is the binding energy of the system, and alpha 1 and alpha 2 are, well, the preferred frame parameters. Nevertheless, what I want to stress is that the weak field calculations for the sensitivity can be wrong by essentially 200% when it comes to chronometric gravity. So the relative error between the exact calculation and the approximate calculation is given here, and by 20% in the case of Einstein ether theory. And this 20% or this 100% makes the whole difference. And this is the reason why, back in 2007, people couldn't place constraints on the theory using binary pulsars. And this is shown in this slide, which is my last slide. So if you're interested in Lorentz violation in gravity, this is what you should bring home from this talk. These are the constraints that we obtain. So again, C plus and C minus are the strong field coupling constants for Einstein ether theory. So these are the coupling constants that are not constrained at all by solar system tests. They are only constrained by stability argument, so absence of ghosts at the linear level and absence of gravitational Cherenkov radiation, the fact that we don't observe any gravitational Cherenkov radiation. And this is the constraint that you would get if you were to take the weak field prediction for the sensitivity seriously. But the correct calculation is actually this region here. So this is the constraint for the coupling constant that we get by comparing to a bunch of white dwarf pulsar and double pulsar systems. So we compare in particular to these three systems here, which are white dwarf neutron stars, and to this system here, which is a famous system. It's made by two pulsars, and they're very close one to another. So it's a very relativistic double pulsar system. And if we take into account all four or five these systems, what we get is that the only viable region of the parameter space is given by this purple region, which is actually zooming onto this region here. So we went from this whole parameter space to just this tiny region. So what we want to, the message to bring home is that Lorentz violation in gravity is very strongly constrained. So the coupling constants now must be to within 0.2% and 3%, and before they were of order one. And this is the same for the chronometric gravity case. This was the bound due to stability. This was the bound, this small orange region here was the bound due to Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And you would naively think, well, it might be hard to do better than BBN, but we actually do better than BBN because the purple region is actually the one that we constrain. So when you, the case for chronometric theory or for the low energy limit of Kojava gravity is even worse. So the coupling constants are now, well, the region is again very, it's tiny, it's very small. So let me say that we did a careful analysis. So we varied the equations of state of the nuclear matter in the neutron stars. We took into account the observational errors on the measurements of the masses of the two pulsars. We took into account the effect of the spins. Actually, the spins, we selected these particular systems because the spins are measured to be tiny. They are 10 to the minus 3. So the inclusion of spins wouldn't change our results at all. The eccentricity of these systems is, again, very small. It's 0.01. So this wouldn't change. We checked that this wouldn't change the shape of our constraint region. So the message to bring home is that Lorentz violation in gravity is very much constrained by binary pulsar observations. So this is essentially, these are essentially my conclusions. So I tried to make the case that whenever you break boost invariance in the gravitational sector, you automatically break the strong equivalence principle. And in particular, you produce dipolar radiation and not just quadrupolar radiation as you would in general relativity. And the strong equivalence principle, on the other hand, is very strongly constrained astrophysically by exactly binary pulsars. So what we do is to calculate, what we did was to compare to the observational results for gravitational emission from binary pulsars. But in order to do so, we had to go through a technical tour de force to calculate these parameters, which are called the sensitivities, which appear in the dipolar flux. And these sensitivities are specific to what they depend on the nature of the object and on the compactness of the object. So we related this sensitivity to some surface integrals, which we could calculate in terms of asymptotic solutions of neutron stars moving relative to the ether. And the result is that the constraints on the strong field coupling constants of Lorentz violation in gravity are an order of magnitude at least stronger than what you could place without using gravitational wave emission. So using what John said at lunch 2 days ago, the binary pulsar is really a killer. So indeed, well, in our case, as it did in the past for Brunsdicker theory or scalar tensor theory, it very much constrains the space, it very much constrains the theory. And there is, from an astrophysical point of view, there is not much room left to further constrain this system, I think. So this is as good as it gets from an astrophysical point of view. Well, this is all I want to say. I think I'm almost on time. So thanks for your attention.